I think the company comes first. If the founder is stuck to the CEO seat, he's probably not the right CEO. Because just like any other leader, different leaders are good for different phases of the company. And eventually, if you have a good board, the board gets to decide whether you're the right leader for this phase. I've seen painfully too often when founders get stuck to the CEO seat and their ego comes in the way, even when it's very apparent that things are not going well. So I think the founders, I would advise to be a little bit humble, especially if they have a good board, work with the board, and objectively, you know, step outside your body for a second. Objectively make a call on whether the company is benefiting from your being the CEO or not at this point, or whether it'll be better served by bringing a different CEO. And you'll still have a role, right? It'll be more suited for the company at that point. And that is a discussion that the founders need to have with their board all through. The problem happens when they're too stuck to the seat, when they start giving weird arguments, even when it's obvious things are not working.
Yep.
And they keep sticking to the seat. Well, what's going to happen after that is good people start leaving because the company is not doing well. Now you're even going to have a hard time bringing a good CEO because the company is not doing well. It just goes south from there. So companies always have a window of time by which to correct the mistakes. If they go too far in not correcting those mistakes, they may not be able to recover. So very important to have a humble founder who can step aside and let someone else come in if the board were to decide collectively that he or she is not the right person at that stage of the company.
From Foundation Capital, this is How to B2B a CEO, the show about how to scale your enterprise startup and how to grow from founder to CEO. I'm Ashok Garg, General Partner at Foundation Capital. On this episode, I interview Mohit Aaron, founder and CEO of Cohesity, and before that, one of the founders of Nutanix. I have known Mohit for more than a decade, and I think he's remarkably thoughtful about deciphering customer feedback and finding product market fit. If you're an entrepreneur whose company is really early, this might be the best episode of the podcast for you to listen to. Or if you know someone who's thinking about starting a company, send them a link to this episode. Because in it, Mohit lays out his framework for how to evaluate whether your startup will be successful before you've ever written the first line of code. He also explains his unique definition of product market fit. For founders who are a little further along, Mohit shares his algorithm for hiring non-technical people and executive hiring. And so Mohit, you have co-founded Nutanix, you've founded Cohesity, you've been early in multiple companies. Do you have a framework for how you evaluate what a successful startup looks like?
I do. I actually like to say that most of the work on evaluating the company is done before the company is even formed. And the result of that is a blueprint that now you execute on, right? Once the blueprint is kind of correct, success will come as long as you stick to the blueprint. So let's go through some essential elements of that framework. Number one, a good company ought to have a very well-defined entry point that people will pay for. It addresses a few pains that they have. It's not a good to have. Number two, it better have a bigger vision that goes beyond that entry point, right? So now these are the essential ingredients on how you start. And I have a whole variety of stuff I can say about, you know, entry points and how you evaluate them and stuff, but this is the key. A product that sells and people pay for, that's the entry point. For us, that's backups. And something that you can grow into that's larger than that. And that's secondary storage for us, right? TAM means total addressable market. Now, the entry point better be worth at least $5 billion in TAM. As in, there should be customers that A, have the pain, and B, are willing to pay for that. If it's just a couple of $100 million, you're going to be fighting with like 10 other vendors, and you're not going to be able to sell.
It's just not worth the
hassle. It's not going to be worth the hassle.
So you need an entry point that has a multi-billion dollar TAM.
Yeah.
What else makes for a good entry point?
So I have, 10 filters that, by the way, are available out there. Someone published them. But let's go through some of them. Number one, of course, is the TAM. The entry point better have a big TAM. Second, it better be a good neighborhood. Your idea will not get funded if you're trying to do an idea in a neighborhood that has a bunch of dead companies, right? Because you might go to the VCs and say that I'm going to do it better than the last 10 guys who came to you. And they're going to say, well, the 10th person who was here also said the same thing. The next one is that the entry point better address some short-term pains. Said another way, it better be an aspirin and not a vitamin, right? Because nobody pays for vitamins. The company will die if it's a vitamin. And at the same time, it better have a vision that goes well beyond that, right? Yet another one is that you better be able to build, if it's an enterprise company, so companies are built either on eyeballs or on dollars, right, in terms of revenue. And there has to be, if you're built on revenue, I think your company better be able to reach about $100 million in revenue in, let's say, 5 to 7 years of announcing the product. If it's eyeballs, you know, you can take your pick. Maybe it's 1 million eyeballs or something. But if the numbers are smaller than that, you're going to have a very, it's not very interesting. The VCs are not going to be interested in funding them. And if some poor guy actually funds you, you're going to have a hard time. Eventually, you're going to make a very small exit, right? Another one is pivot points, where I might be, you know, drinking my own Kool-Aid. I might think that this is the best idea in the world. My entry point is going to fly like hotcakes. But by the time I actually roll out the product, nobody's biting. So I need to have some pivot points, some additional entry points that I can pivot to. So I can quickly kind of go over to those as opposed to kind of pursuing a direction that's not working.
And so you would have a plan B in place?
Absolutely. I'll have multiple plans in place. In Cohesity, the primary one was backups, which by the way works. But the other things that we can fail over to, if that had not worked, was to basically build it like an analytics platform. So you ingest data through backups, but then provide value using analytics or test and dev. Now, do they not have to be pursued anymore now that we are successful with backups? No, they just become part of our vision. We just expanded them. So, but it's necessary to have those pivot points because then you architect the product with those in mind. It's very hard to change your product later once it's polished and now you're like imposing one more requirement. Oh, oops, I didn't think about that. That doesn't work. So I have a few more of these.
Anything else that comes to mind?
The total addressable market should be measured correctly. I find a lot of companies measuring their TAM incorrectly. What they will say, for example, if they're trying to do something in, let's say, the analytics space, they will take the TAM of all the analytics industry, right? Be it $20, $30 billion, and they'll say, that's my TAM. No, no, that's not your TAM. Because if your TAM is, if you're wildly successful, what's the your revenue? If you kill all competition in what you do, that's your TAM. You don't want to kill all sorts of analytics out there, right? So that's not your TAM. Your TAM is
you're spot on. I think this is one of the biggest mistakes founders make.
Right.
Is it's a very naive view of what the addressable market is. And they people invent all kinds of creative definitions. Right. And it's actually pretty straightforward. The total addressable market is, if you had 100% market share, what would revenues be?
And the best misconception I've seen is people who do companies in, let's say, the desktop market. And the whole desktop space, every PC ever sold is their TAM. So next one is, how long will it take the competitors to copy the product? Because you may have the coolest idea in the world. As soon as it gets out, people will try to copy. If they can copy it in 3 months, you really don't have a company.
Business.
You have a company if there's a significant barrier of entry. At least there's a 1 to 2 year lead. So the important point is by the time they copy you and they've copied the entry point, you've built further on your vision. That's how you stay ahead of the game. That's how Google stayed ahead in search, even when Yahoo and Microsoft tried to copy it. That's how Apple stayed ahead in the smartphone industry, when like in the especially the music player industry, when Zune and all the other try to copy. Yet another one is, are the industry trends with you? Or are you fighting industry trends? When the industry trends are with you, the world is working for you. When the industry trends are against you, you're working against the world. It never works. You're swimming upstream. An example is my last company, Nutanix. I think Nutanix was all about building one platform that consolidates compute, storage, and networking. Now, if you think about it, in the last 20 years, compute and storage have grown phenomenally.
Yep.
Networking has not. Networking, I used to have, in 2000, the networking that came to my desktop was a gigabit. And today, the networking that comes to my desktop is a gigabit. You can argue that, okay, maybe in the data center, it has grown a little bit. 10 gig is the commodity. But okay, networking might have grown by a factor of 10, when compute and storage have grown way more. So doesn't it make sense to be aligned with the industry trends and get networking out of the way and put all of that on one platform, right? So Nutanix, in that way, was aligned with the trends. All the other companies that were trying to build SANs and whatnots, They kind of against the trend. They were still trying to fetch the data from across the network, and they ran into
and they failed. Yeah.
So that's just one example. And then I can give other examples where there are companies that are building their business on email archiving, for instance. Now email is moving to the cloud. So if you have a business trying to do something on-prem on email, I think you will...
You have a couple of years to go, but it's all moving to the cloud anyway.
Yeah. Yet another one I have is the insertion point good? So when you place the product in the customer's hand, is it an additional headache to manage, or is it a joy? It simplifies their environment, right? Because nobody likes an additional headache. They're going to go to their existing vendors and say, why can't you do this? Why should I have to buy this company? And so that's another filter that I use.
So let's push this insertion point a little bit, because I think you're spot on. You want to build a platform, but you want to sell an application. And your first application is your insertion point.
I call it the entry point.
The entry point. And the challenge a lot of founders have is they have ideas about entry point, but they're not able to go from idea to actually getting the first 10 or 20 customers that show you that you have product market fit. So walk us through how you iterate, because you've done it multiple times, and I'm sure you've seen companies that you've helped or advised that have not done it well.
The key here, Ashu, is to be brutally honest on your evaluation, because you need to evaluate the market, and you need to ask questions that bring out the pain the customer has, not a good to have. Just an example, I was just speaking to an entrepreneur recently who was doing something in test and dial. And I asked the person, let's play, you know, a role. Let me be the CIO of a company, and you're asking me questions. What would you ask me? So he was trying to do something in test and dial. And the question he says, I, as a CIO, want to run my environment faster. And as a CIO, I'm like, no, I don't have that problem. So you need to really nail down what the problem is, right? You need to have the CIO tell you what the problem is. And then you have a company. And the CIO needs to also tell you that he's willing to pay you a lot of money to solve that problem. You don't want to enforce what you think is a good to have on the CIO and then go and drink your own Kool-Aid and go do a company. Because by the time you do a company and come back to the CIO says, A, I don't have that problem. B, I don't want to pay too much for it because it's not a real pain. So you got to be brutally honest with you on what a real problem is. Let me give some examples from my last two companies. Cohesity, when we went and spoke to customers, they were pained that they have to pay more building up a backup infrastructure than they were even paying for their primary, the stuff that was being backed up. That was a real pain. If we can cut that down, they were willing to pay right there. Second, they were pained by having to manage 3 or 4 different vendors to maintain their backup environment. When a problem happens, who should be the guy I should call? That guy or that guy? When a license expiration happens, this guy expired. How does he work with that guy? It was just a mess. So we knew this was something they would pay for. Similarly, at Nutanix, the problem, our entry point was VDI. VDI was very expensive. If you put together VDI on a traditional three-tier architecture, where storage and compute sit differently and get connected using some expensive networking, by the time you build that platform up for VDI, it's very expensive. I might as well give a laptop, an expensive laptop, to everyone, right? So Nutanix came and knew that if we can drop down the cost of that, we have a solution. People will pay for it. And the way to do that was to consolidate, and that cuts down the cost, improves manageability, and here we have an entry point which is much cheaper.
So in both cases, and these are great examples, in both cases, you were able to very quickly validate that there was a clear, hard cost benefit.
That's right. Pain can be in cost. It could be in manageability. It could be in any, but...
Yeah, but you had both in this case.
That's right.
There was a clear cost benefit, which is very quantifiable, and your solution was easier for them to use.
That is correct.
Did you also think about other variables? For example, the new solution has to work in an existing environment because people are not going to rip out everything that they already have.
So absolutely. When you start by asking these questions, then you say, okay, it seems like that we have something here that they will pay for. But what exactly now does the product look like? This is where the insertion point comes in, right? I give the customer something that he doesn't like, even if it solves the pain points, they may not pay for it, or even if they do, they will ask other vendors to build something like that, and then I don't have a business. So you really have to think on what your product needs to look like to get inserted in that environment and how it's going to coexist with other technologies. So, but that I would still say is a follow-up to the first essential question, are they going to pay for it? Is there a real pain here? If they don't have a pain, if it's just a good to have, they will never pay for it. They'll keep telling you, come after 6 months, you know, I may have a budget after 6 months, and those 6 months never happen, and very soon your company is looking to go belly up, right? So very important to have that entry point and a real pain that people will pay for. And by the way, they better pay big. Remember that $5 billion TAM? If they're only paying, you know, I don't know, $1,000, how many millions of customers you need to have before you have significant revenue? It doesn't work. So you need to do some cost analysis, and the cost analysis we did in the backup world, we compared to the competing products, and we found that they were very expensive. And even if we cut down the cost by half, that gives us a phenomenal margin, and we don't have to have millions of customers to build a phenomenally big company. So that's the kind of thinking that goes behind building that framework for a company.
And you did all of this thinking even before you started writing code?
Even before I actually even incorporated the company.
Wow. So you had a very clear point of insertion.
Yeah.
You had a very clear business case identified. You had done the economics of what the business would look like. Then you incorporated the company. And obviously raising money was a breeze. You had done this before. Right. And so you had capital in the bank very quickly. What's next?
Well, there is one more step. The blueprint also involves literally a plan. So now you kind of know the setting is correct. You have an entry point that people will pay for. You have a vision that you can expand into. But every company has a window of time. You know, markets may shift over time. So what you need is a plan of execution. And I like my plans in Gantt charts. You can use your own favorite tool. But the bottom line is you need to have milestones that you know you're going to deliver on, and you need to have time attached to them, right? So I knew every quarter what part of my product is going to be delivered. I knew how many people are going to be hiring. I knew when I'm going to be hiring the first sales guy. I knew when I'm going to be hiring the first marketing guy. When I took money from Sequoia in November of 2013, I told them 2 years later, I'm going to GA this company. And in October 2015 was when we GA'd the company. And that was because it was all laid out. That's what I call the blueprint. Now it's a matter of executing on the blueprint, right? It's very predictable. And VCs love predictability.
That's for sure. Never surprise your investors in a board meeting. We'll be right back.
If hiring engineers isn't keeping you up at night, either your company's not growing or you already know about touring. Listeners of this podcast know that finding the right team is critical to the success of your startup, but recruiting in the Valley is time-consuming and expensive. That's why touring exists. Touring helps companies hire remote, Google-caliber engineers at less than half the cost with the push of a button. To clear Turing's engineering bar, developers need to pass a rigorous 40-hour coding challenge. We accept less than 1% of developers who apply. Turing has fully vetted developers today for full stack, front end, back end, iOS, Android, AI, and data science roles. You pay only for hours worked and have the option to scale up on demand. So if you're ready to hire elite software engineers, go to Turing.com and sign up for our 2-week trial. That's Turing.com. If you don't like the work your engineer has done in the first 2 weeks, pay nothing. Go to Turing.com to double your runway today.
So now you have capital, you have a blueprint.
Right.
What's next?
So initial phases of the company are all about what I call reaching what I call product market fit. And we'll define that in a second. But before I do that, I think I'll point our listeners to the technology adoption lifecycle. This was a curve that was proposed by Jeffrey Moore in a book called Crossing the Chasm. So the beginning stages of the company are all about crossing the chasm, right? So you start by maybe selling to some early adopters. These guys, maybe they are your friends, they like you, they want to help you, maybe they're friends of your VCs. They form 10 to 15% of your initial market. They're not the guys who are going to make you a unicorn, a billion-dollar company. But they are important to take the company off. Then come what is called the early majority, as Jeffrey Moore defines it. These are the guys who will make your company. They're the people who normally will not buy from a startup. They will buy only from branded companies. The only reason they're looking at you is because you have a solution and they have a pain that your solution can address. And no other branded company can address that, which is why the entry point better have a pain, right? All the stuff that we spoke about. But these guys are used to buying from branded companies. So they'll give you a lot of pain. They will give you, okay, I you know, you're missing these 10. A lot of friction in the process. You're missing these 10 features. You don't have this polish. Your UI doesn't look great. So every time you sell to them, it's a big, heavy lift. But once you convert one of those customers, the next one becomes easier, right? And the next one becomes easier still. And once you have enough of these, you start magic. You start a tornado. You basically are in a product market fit. You've achieved repeatability. My definition of a product market fit is that when you can hire an average sales guy and he can sell to an average customer without involving the headquarters, you have a product market fit. Because it means that now you can scale the company in a repeatable fashion. I can just keep on hiring more sales guys and then can keep on selling to more customers without putting more load on headquarters, right?
So average sales guy selling to an average customer without headquarters support is product market fit.
That is correct.
That's a very high bar.
That is a very high bar, but that's what most companies become famous when they hit that.
Right.
Google, you name it, Google, Facebook, Twitter, all those guys, when we found out about those companies, they had already kind of became repeatable.
So when you hit that bar of product market fit, then you're ready to just pour gasoline on the fire and get into, escape velocity.
Absolutely. If you try to pour gasoline on the fire before that, you're going to drown your headquarters. People are going to start leaving, right? There's going to be, imagine if every sale you make requires a senior person that sits in headquarters to get engaged. Now, by the time you have 1,000 customers, people in the headquarters are going nuts. So your company is not scalable. This is not a product market fit. But once you've reached product market fit, you'll just see money coming in, revenue coming in, because it just keeps on scaling. It's a repeatable model. So
how do you know that that's happening? Definition of product market fit?
Yeah, you kind of only know that in hindsight. But the way it happens is suddenly your sales guys are bringing you, in my world, million-dollar deals without any involvement from anyone I know that's sitting in the headquarters. It doesn't involve my VP of engineering. It doesn't involve me. The deal just comes. We just closed a huge telecom, can't name the account, but a huge telecom giant. And literally, there was very little involvement from anyone in the headquarters. And the same thing goes.
Which is an amazing place to be.
Yeah.
But it takes most companies many, many years to get there. So I want to unwind a little bit to the point of, you've identified the pain point, you've identified the value proposition, you have this blueprint, you're ready to launch a product. Walk us through sort of when you were there, what did you, what are the lessons learned from your multiple experiences? What did you do really well? What are some of the mistakes you made as you were launching to the first handful of customers?
I think what I did really well was the setting up the plan. And by the way, we can really set up the plan up until the GA announcing the product. And then take our best guess on how much time it will take to refine the product, to make it repeatable, to achieve that product market fit. I normally would give 1 year. My company, Cohesity, and that's a mistake, it took us more than 1 year. It took us, I think, somewhere between 1.5 to 2 years. So it varies from company to company. But you have to give yourself that time. That's the important part. And then beyond that, you need to plan for more expansion, more funding. So I think we did that fairly well, as best as it can be done. Where I made a lot of mistakes was in hiring people. I started Cohesity. I was a technical person. I've been a technical person throughout my life. And I thought that even the non-technical people ought to be hired sort of with the same algorithm that you hire the technical people. So let's go through that. It's actually pretty interesting. How do we hire technical people? We schedule a bunch of interviews. We look at the person's resume. He has a good pedigree. He's been in a couple of good universities.
Yep.
You call him for an interview. You call he or she. You ask the person a few, puzzles, programming puzzles. And by the end of it, you have a fairly good idea.
You're hiring for intellect and potential.
That's right. And you're hiring also for problem solving. And they've solved some problems in front of you, right? You have a fairly good idea whether the person is good or not. Let's try to apply this to a non-business person. First of all, it's not possible to ask puzzles on the boat, right?
Sort of to a non-technical person.
So let's say you're hiring a sales guy or a marketing person. The kind of questions you're going to ask them, they're going to just regurgitate what they saw in their prior life. Whether they can actually do it or not, you can't prove it. So I made a lot of mistakes there. I made a lot of bad hires. Fortunately, we had to fix them and we went through pain. I'll give you my new algorithm for hiring people. The old algorithm is basically, if I like the person, right, he's answering my questions correctly, and I find he's a great person, I connect with the person, there's a good chemistry match, all right, let's hire the person. So what I found was that since I was looking for a chemistry match, the chemistry remained great throughout. But the person's delivery was a shot in the dark, right? And eventually when we got rid of such people, it was because of they couldn't deliver. So what's the new algorithm? First, I like using checklists now. I divide up the interview into three phases. First is a pre-interview phase. So I have a checklist for that, right? The checklist is role-specific. So let's say I'm hiring for sales. The checklist would be, for example, has the person been in some relevant companies? Maybe has he or she done a startup before, right? What's has he or she delivered big numbers? If this is a leadership role, has he or she managed a big team, right? So those are the pre-interview checklists. If the person doesn't meet the checklist, and the checklist can be specific to the situation the company is in, right? Early stage company may not be looking for a leader who has managed a lot of people, mm-hmm. but a later stage company might be. So it's very specific
to stage, situation, that's right, that's role. Right.
And I would say that the people write job descriptions. I am totally against job descriptions in the form of paragraphs because they never get followed. I would highly encourage that job descriptions should be in the form of a checklist, right? So that's the first thing. If they don't meet my checklist, and it doesn't have to be perfect. If you have, you know, I don't know, 5 things on your checklist or 10 things on your checklist, your threshold could be 80%, that they need to meet at least 80%, right? But beyond that, it doesn't work.
You've got to meet a threshold of the checklist even to interview.
That's right. So I won't waste time because the biggest problem that happens is I like the person as a nice guy, and now my emotions are saying that I should hire this person, right? So the checklist kind of cuts that out. Now, the in interview, especially for a non-technical person, I believe you can find out, A, whether that person is a chemistry match, a culture fit in the org. And the other thing you can find out is whether the person has some obvious red flags, right? So if I'm hiring for, I don't know, a sales leadership role, and the person doesn't even know how to manage forecasting, it's a red flag, right? So you can find out red flags like that. But it's incredibly hard for non-technical interviews to actually find out the positives, right? Can this person actually deliver?
Because they can tell stories.
They can tell stories. You don't know if the stories are true.
That's
right. They can tell stories from what they've seen. So that's where I go to the third phase of the interview. First was a pre-interview checklist. The second checklist is an in-interview checklist where I'm checking for culture fit. I'm checking for specific red flags. Does he know sales management? He or she knows sales management. Does he know this or that? And I'm taking sales as an example, but also applies to marketing. The third one is a post-interview checklist where one of the important items there is to do reference checks. Now, some reference checks come from people the person will give to you. Let me caution you, those guys are always going to speak positive about the person. They're useful. They're useful to validate the positives. So you already have an idea of what the positives are. You validate them with this guy. And you have an idea of what the negatives are. So you ask questions like, what can I do to compensate for this? So this person who's a supporter will tell you, well, if you hire this guy and he compliments this person, that would be great, right? So that's why they're useful. But the real important thing is to get references from peers and people who reported to that candidate. They will tell you the red flags. Remember, I excluded bosses. Bosses do not tell you the red flags. Bosses kind of view, these are my kids, I owe it to the person.
To help them succeed.
Yeah, they'll hide
it. They had a problem.
That's right.
There's usually some understanding that you scratch my back, I scratch your back.
So they will hide the red flags. So bosses are not reliable. I think the bosses are best for, again, verifying the positives. But peers, people who've kind of worked with the person in a peer capacity, and people who've reported to the person, find those guys out, especially when they're blind references. Talk to them. They will tell you whether the person can actually deliver or not. And now between these three different parts of the interview, I can tell you there's a very high probability you'll have a hit. You know, a little bit of legwork in the beginning will save you so much pain later on, right? And this was a mistake I made. I didn't value executive recruiters, or I tried to save money on them. And so my pipeline was small. I was given candidates by my board, and I would decide between them. And I've come to now appreciate that the money we spent, you know, roughly a good executive recruiter would cost about $90,000 or something, $90,000. It's not cheap, but in the big scheme of things, you go wrong on a person, it's going to cost you millions to undo that damage, right? So spending that $90,000 and getting a huge pipeline, a big pipeline of qualified good candidates, is priceless, because now you can apply your algorithm on that bigger pipeline as opposed to a much smaller pipeline and then choosing sort of, you know, the lesser of two evils or something like that. So I would highly encourage our listeners to not cut corners on recruiting.
I wanted to come back to sort of the comment you made around the early adopters versus the early majority. Mm-hmm. And as you pointed out, you know, your first handful of customers will always be early adopters, and you have to make the transition to the early majority. Do you have a point of view on how quickly to make that transition? Should one try to get early majority from day one, or are you okay with just focusing on the early adopters for the first year or so?
Yeah, so the early majority is looking for polish, right? They're used to buying from branded companies. If your product is still kind of unstable, clearly you shouldn't even try, right? Because look, they're not there to waste your time, or they don't want their time wasted. You go to a person and your product is falling, they're just going to tell you to go home, right? And they won't even give you the second meeting. So that's why at least you should get your product polished or somewhat polished with the early adopters, right? The early adopters are a little bit more forgiving. They'll give you feedback. I don't like this, that failed, whatever, right? And once you feel that you're kind of there, then you should start tinkering with the early majority. So there is no clear timeline, but you kind of know that I think now the early adopters are biting and they seem to be happy with your products. So the early adopter himself is going to give you some feedback. And if they see your environment seems to be stable and working for an early adopter, that's a good sign that maybe you should now seek out an early majority customer. And by the way, how do you even identify that it's an early majority customer and not a late majority customer, who, by the way, will not buy from you no matter what? They will only buy from branded companies. The way I seek that out is I look for what else they're buying. If they're buying newer products, for example, if they're buying products from my last company, Nutonix, it's probably an early majority customer. If they're only buying legacy three-letter word companies, they're probably not.
They're not going to be a good fit for a while.
That's right. Yeah. They're not going to be good fit
for a while. So it's, you do a mental lookalike modeling.
That's right. And that's where I like building channel businesses. My business, both at Nutonix and Cohesity, is 100% channel fulfilled. We go through the channel. The channel knows these answers. They know who's buying what. They know that that other company bought Pure or Nutonix or any of the newer companies. And very likely they're willing to look at newer companies too.
And do you have a checklist that you give the channel, just though, like you have a checklist for hiring? Does the channel have a checklist for what customers to go after?
So we try to educate the partners exactly on what to look for in a customer. Maybe we call it trigger points, because there could be a customer who has the pain but not yet ready to move. So one of the trigger points could be they're coming up with license expiration for their existing backup software or storage or what have you. That could be a trigger point. They have at least, 50 terabytes of stuff to be backed up, right? So we give them a checklist to look for, and that really streamlines. Otherwise, they'll go waste their time, and they don't have a customer that bites, they'll lose interest in you. Remember, you're not a branded company right now. So you have to prove to channel partners that it's worth their time to spend on you. So unless you become very refined, and so checklist really helps, test for these five things. And if the customer meets these five things, only then go more. That way it saves their time. Your sale will happen and they get super interested. Oh boy, I have a product here that actually sells. Let's do more. Because they're being approached by 10 other vendors to sell their products. Who should they spend time on, your product or the other nine guys, right? And if you can streamline that process, if you can actually show, you can close the deals with little friction and you can put some commissions in their hands, boy, they love you. And that's how you kickstart the business.
Any other advice for entrepreneurs that are just about to launch the product in the market? So between the point of no customers and your definition of product market fit, what other mistakes have you made or seen others make?
Yeah, I think leadership hiring is where I've made a lot of mistakes. So first of all, let me just say that leaders are of two kinds. One is a rising star who's kind of not done it before, but they can grow and grow with the company. And the second kind of leader is a person who's done it before and they pull the company with them, right? So when you're looking for leaders, look for one of these two. B, I think when you're early, look, you don't have a name. Most entrepreneurs don't have a reputation. Their company doesn't have a reputation. So it's very hard to get a leader who's been there, done that before. You'll probably look for a rising star. So you need to understand that the company goes through stages and different kind of leaders are needed at different stages of the company. Some leaders are able to transcend as the company gets mature.
Absolutely.
But
yeah.
many are not. Earlier phases of the company, you're probably looking more for rising stars. Later stages of the company, you're probably looking more for the been there, done that kinds, right? And earlier stages of the company, you don't have enough money. You raised a small round from the VCs. So you have to pick where you need to get the leaders and the other parts that you can manage yourself. Probably you began with the product. So you may want to start by just managing the product yourself. But then once the engineering team is somewhat big, look for a good leader in engineering, right? But when you start sales, you bring a rising star or what have you, the person doesn't have anything to sell. The guy's like, I was doing, you know, $20 million of business at the other company. I'm doing zero here. I'm not making any commissions. I'm going. So you need to probably not even hire a leader up front. You hire a troop and let that guy run for a while. And then once some business
then
comes
you put
in,
a leader in place.
Then you put a leader in place. So there's a way to build this. And sometimes inexperienced entrepreneurs are too much in a rush to bring in like big names and VPs and whatnot. It always goes south because those guys are used to doing big stuff earlier and they get bored. This is an unpolished product. Why, what the hell am I doing here?
Or they spend all their time building out a larger team as against doing doing things.
So I like to sometimes compare building a company to building a huge building. You need to lay the foundation before you do the rest. You can't start painting the walls.
Hence the name Foundation Capital.
You can't start painting the walls before you've properly laid the foundation. So it builds in a certain way. You build it too fast, eventually the foundation will remain weak and eventually it'll crumble. So build the foundation, make sure the foundation is stable, give it time to work, see evidence that it is stable, then build on top, right? And then build on top. And this is how you do it.
That's it for this episode. You can find past episodes and subscribe to future ones on iTunes, Stitcher, and SoundCloud. How to B2B a CEO is brought to you by Foundation Capital, an early stage venture capital firm with 27 IPOs, including Netflix, Lending Club, TubeMogul, and Sunrun. I'm Ashu Garg, a general partner at Foundation Capital. I'm passionate about helping B2B entrepreneurs who are trying to solve hard problems. So if this podcast speaks to you, if you are interested in growing from a technical founder into a business leader, drop me a line. Thanks and see you next time.